The Lord is with you. The desert fathers hid in caves or up on poles, and they starved themselves. Ancient shaman sipped peyote and ayahuasca and took vision quests. Grand temples, stones in the earth, pyramids, monasteries, cathedrals. People have tried all sorts of techniques and steps and formulas, meditations, sacred shrines, miles and miles of holy pilgrimage, nature walks at sunrise or sunset. Trees, animals, ancestor worship, ecstatic prayers, rituals, poetry, songs, sculptures, paintings, sex. A really big and bloody assortment of burnt offerings, blood offerings, animal sacrifice, human sacrifice. Fridge magnets, shaped like scrolls and doves. A picture of that Footprints poem. Precious moments, figurines and cartoons. Daily devotions from Our Daily Bread. Memory verses. Rock bands. Pipe organs. Choral music. Ouija boards, tea leaves, crystal balls, star charts, telescopes, microscopes, particle accelerators, mass spectrometers. It's already been a pretty long list, but I could go on and on. All of these things represent the wide assortment of efforts to push the limits of human knowledge and understanding, ways of seeing, ways of hearing, ways of listening, experiencing and knowing. Real people seeking insight, spiritual truth, experience. We're hungry for the secrets of the universe, and sometimes it is about our personal growth. But often, if we're honest, these efforts are just a grasping for some sort of reassurance, hope, and meaning for another day. We have so many questions about our Creator. And it doesn't matter when you were born, what age or time or place, this pursuit has been a part of the human experience. What culture or civilization did you grow up in? The end goal was often enough some sort of transcendence, knowledge, power, enlightenment. Maybe you called it salvation. Maybe it was just provision. Was it holiness? People have tried almost anything, and I mean anything, to get closer to the divine, to hear the voice of God. And we push and we pray and we listen and we wait, all for a chance to maybe just peel back a little corner of the veil of reality. To know and experience a tiny bit of the vital spark of the universe, the purpose behind all of this, the divine presence, the glory of the Lord, a glimpse of the heavenly realm. Of course, the scriptures tell us stories about people who experience this sort of thing. Two of the most prominent examples are Moses and Elijah. God's special people, chosen prophets, living oracles who were given unparalleled access to the word and presence of a living God. You may recall the story of that time when Moses received a special visit and he was exposed to a nearly fatal dose of holiness when he was given that tiny, brief glimpse of God's glory, if only through a cleft in the rock. Elijah was the prophet who called down fire from heaven one time. The man who once stood and waited on Mount Horeb, and there he heard the whisper of God in the crushed silence. And when his days were done, as if a life of miracles and wonder wasn't enough, Elijah rode off to heaven in a chariot made of fire carried by a whirlwind. So I guess it makes sense when there's a crossover episode between the Old Testament and the New Testament that Moses and Elijah are there. The men of miracle and wonder stand at Jesus' transfiguration. When I think of all the trouble and all the pains and all the doubts and all the struggle of so many devout and earnest religious people through all of history and prehistory even, all the blood spilled and the sweat poured out, all those hours in worship and prayer, I don't know about you, but it seems so unfair to me that this generic assortment of semi-skilled local boys from Galilee, Peter, James, and John, they get to have an experience like the Transfiguration. Think about it. They just wander off with this rabbi guy named Jesus. They misunderstand almost everything he says. And after following up a hill one day, they catch a glimpse of the mind-blowing glimpse of the eternal glory of the creator of the universe. They got to have that experience, the ultimate epiphany moment. Because there's nothing else quite like this in all of the Gospels. This is a rare and amazing experience and such a treat. Even in the scope of all the other Gospel miracles, there is really something special and different about the Transfiguration. Why is this happening? Why did Jesus share this moment with three of his friends and then immediately tell them to keep it a secret? Well, for a start, every now and then when we read these Gospels, we are given a pointed reminder, a double underlined, fluorescent yellow highlighted bold text and italic section that effectively lays to rest any suggestion that Jesus is just another wise man, just another cool guy, just another man of history doing parlor tricks for the local crowd. The Transfiguration is that moment when Mark's gospel makes every effort to let us know this story is about God revealed in a new way, an amazing way. The Transfiguration is an apocalypse story. Here's the thing, though. Pop culture and the movies have been lying to you for quite a while now because apocalypse doesn't actually mean the end of the world. Not really. Apocalypse means uncovering, exposing something that's been hidden. An apocalypse story is a revealing story. Jesus, son of Joseph, that handyman, rabbi from Nazareth, being made known. Transformed and uncovered. The Christ revealed in dazzling white, clouded in glory, and a voice from the heavens declares, "This is my Son, the Beloved. Listen to him." Now, there's been a lot of speculation over the years. What exactly did the disciples see up on that mountaintop on that crazy day? And the more people you ask, the more answers you get. A lot of the signs point to Jesus' resurrection. Jesus talks about his death and his resurrection in and around this story. If this is, in fact, a resurrection preview, a glimpse into the future, for a moment, these three disciples see well into the future and are given a glimpse of Christ risen in all his glory. Other theologians will tell you that this is a glimpse of the Christ that has always been, the Christ for all time, the divine logos, the pre-incarnate Christ meets the mortal. The eternal and the mortal come together at the Transfiguration. And there the disciples caught a glimpse of eternity. They got to see into that non-physical realm, a time outside of time and space, the place where Alpha and Omega live, the beginning and the end. Maybe you'll say, why not both of those things? Maybe more even. Because the Transfiguration could also be a moment in real time, a time for the disciples when they get to see a sort of VIP backstage lanyard around your neck pass, and they get to see the hidden glory that Jesus carried around with him all the time. Even when they were looking at their regular-looking Nazareth friend, that hidden glory was with them every day. Do you remember that Moses story that we talked about earlier? One of my favorite quotes about the Transfiguration comes from the second century bishop Irenaeus, who said, "The flesh of Christ is that cleft in the rock where Moses stood while he saw God." Honestly, the Transfiguration is and will always be an enormous mystery. But it does raise some really important questions about what a life of faith looks like today. Is the glory of God a distant thing? A far-off reality, a realm beyond our capacity where, as mere mortals, God's pure holiness and light only comes to visit our world in little moments of isolated splendor for just a couple of people every now and then? God's glory is a blip on the timeline of human existence for a chosen few. Or is the glory of the Lord, Christ's glory, always with us, near and ever present, as close as the air we breathe? Because Christ is the enlivening force in all of creation, the prevailing and the miraculous reality that makes black holes and elephants and photons and buttercups. Is God's grandeur distant and forever beyond our reach, or are we, for the most part, born blind to glory that shines out in everything like the sun? I do think both of these things play out in their own way. God is hidden, frustratingly so. And God is deeply present to us. My suspicion is that most of us are in need of regular work, rhythmic, regular practice to see the glory of Christ that surrounds us all the time. We need thoughtful worship. We need to practice meditation and mindfulness. We need the slow and the steady rhythms to speak to our impatient and our anxious souls. The organizers of the church calendar round out the season of Epiphany with the Transfiguration, and that's not a mistake. They close out this season with the most wondrous and crazy and puzzling and mysterious and impossibly strange Bible story. And that's because Epiphany is that time when we open our imaginations and our hearts and our lives to the wildest and the strangest and amazing wonderings and possibilities and discoveries about the promises of God. Epiphany is a time for our most dazzling and speculative and hopeful theology. It's a time of wonder and surprise. Epiphany is about having our low expectations replaced by bewildered grace, gratitude beyond words, because Epiphany is about the inbreaking of the light of God's goodness made known in our midst. During Epiphany, we are reminded that creatures like us, for all of our littleness, our frailty, our diminished capacity, and our all-too-short existence, we get to participate in God's eternity. For me, a great help in seeing this way, a great help for my imagination, has come from a genius poet and Jesuit priest from the 19th century named Gerard Manley Hopkins. And what do you know, Jeremy has another poetry insert in the bulletin. A beautiful, what is this, lavender? Are we calling that lavender? The colorblind guy got it right. Good for me. It's a really cool icon that I've scrubbed off the internet. You'll notice that he's got, look at the kingfisher in the picture. That's because one of his most famous poems is about a kingfisher. But you'll also see that in the background, there's like a factory belching out smoke. He had a pretty amazing way of talking about the beauty of the world while also acknowledging all the mess we make of it sometimes. Any Hopkins fans in the house? Yeah? No? Any brave readers want to read us this poem? No? I've done this, but I sang this one the last time I did this, no? Yeah, that's right. Joyce, get up here. Awesome. Let's just wait. Hey, let's just give a... Come on. Yeah. Audience participation. Woo.
Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brightened cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal chestnuts falls, finches wings, landscape plotted and pierced, fold, fallow, and plow, all and all trades their gear and tackle and trim. All things counter, original, spare, strange. Whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how? With swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle dim, he fathers forth, whose beauty is past change. Praise him.
Thank you, Joyce. It's kind of amazing that Hopkins almost has to reinvent and mangle the English language sometimes just to name the ways that he sees God at work in the world. Maybe you've got someone in your life that's helped stir your imagination this way. Is it in the arts? Is it some great writer? Is it a philosopher? Is it your spice cupboard? Or your garden? We need these things to keep us connected so that we don't just see all these things around us and write them off. Call them just more stuff. So hold on, you might say. Jeremy, and I know the realists are in the room right now. It sounds a bit like you're trying to push some sort of delusional fantasy, romantic religion on us. But sitting in the pew right now, I just want to tell you, your denial of stark reality is obnoxious. Thank you very much. You do read the news, don't you, Jeremy? Is this view of God and the world a gross neglect of all the suffering and pain in our lives? That's a fair point. To which I say, friends, this is the last Sunday of Epiphany. There will be plenty of time for prayerful consideration, frustration, puzzlement, quiet questions about mortality, lament, bodily suffering, even darkness. You've got the whole season of Lent for that. But we're not quite there yet. And besides, training our hearts to see this way shouldn't make us blind to the pain of the world. Quite the opposite, actually, because it is when we see the radiant treasure that is the people and the places all around us, when we know the deep beauty of the earth beneath our feet, when we begin to see this way, our lives can never be the same. People who see with the eyes of Christ, they redeem desecrated places. They live vital and real and necessary lives. Even during Epiphany, chances are, though, we may not see beyond the veil of glory as those three disciples did. If you do, be sure and come and tell the story. But in that time, we do listen. We listen and we follow the one who brings everything together. Can it be our prayer, even as we finish out Epiphany, that the Spirit will give us eyes to see the world this way? Transforming, transfiguring what we thought was ordinary and mundane and regular and boring into the miraculous displays of grace and wonder that we live in every day. So in the weeks ahead, may we have our imagination shaped, and may the presence of Christ shape our hearts and our lives as we take this way of seeing seriously and this way of being out into the world every day.